tad out of order. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2639. And would love to have Representative Vicki Berger come up.
Thank you, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative of District 20. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really appreciate your indulgence. I am, as you probably understand, due elsewhere shortly and wanted just a chance to introduce House Bill 2639 to you and my thoughts on it. I don't know whether Representative Esquivel will have a chance to join us or not. This is the second session for me to introduce a bill like this. The one from last session was a little more stringent than this one. I'm trying to get it passed, and you know how that process works. This bill was brought to me by Kate Groh, who is a constituent of mine, and when I heard her story, and you will hear her story today, because she is in the room, I was moved to think hard and long about some of these things. And in conjunction with that, I have had other conversations with folks about our current licensing requirement. And also, I have grandchildren in Portland, and I visit them once a week, and I have events in Portland a lot. I drive the freeway between here and Portland frequently. These things converge in this bill in the sense that it's terrifying out there on those highways. It's just plain terrifying. And it takes all of everything we've got to manage a car and all the things in our lives and all the traffic and everything that we do. We need to be sharp when we're in a car and when we're driving in a car. And I am also getting to the point in my life where I realize that things just aren't as sharp about me as they used to be. My eyes have gone bad. I'm wearing glasses all the time now, when it used to be an occasional thing. When I go downstairs, I go down one stair at a time. I used to bolt downstairs. Funny how that works. So I'm aware that as we get older, we physically change. And I am not against old people, and I am not against old people driving. But in Oregon, we very conveniently go 8 years, 8 years, without ever having to enter a DMV. That is a long time, and last session I had a guy come in and say, you know, my mother's 92, she just got her license renewed, and when she walked out, she said, I'm good to 100. And that's great, you know, for her. But how's she going to do in the next 8 years? This is a legitimate question that all of us who are on the highways need to ask. So what we're trying to do with this bill, and I will suggest that it needs some amendments, is try and say, okay, if you're over a certain age, and in this bill it's 75, and is that arbitrary? Yes. In some sense, it seems like a reasonable arbitrary number, that you come in every 4 years. And at least walk into the DMV and have a certain amount of testing of your abilities. The bill, and I will call your attention to page 2, line 11, or 10 and 11. It actually calls for two tests, and it was our intention, and my co-sponsor is in agreement with this, that the second test be taken out. But you know how it is to get an amendment these days. So in other words, on line 10, test the person's eyesight under ORS 807.070, and take out the person's ability to operate a motor vehicle under ORS 807.0703. And the reason we're taking that is the full drive test. Okay? And we think it's a good idea, but we don't think we're going to get it. And for a lot of older people, it would be such an anxiety-producing thing that it's almost not worth doing. Let me explain to you what I think really happens on the ground and why I think this is a reasonable thing. I think most older drivers realize that, as I do, they're not as physically adept. I think they self-limit how much driving they do, and that's a good thing. We also, and I know ODOT will describe to you the program that we have for reporting for medical folks, and it's a good program. I agree with that. But I also think 8 years is too long, and there are too many older people who aren't being monitored regularly by their family or their friends. Unless you know of a problem, you think that older people are doing fine alone. And coming in every 4 years to have to physically walk into a DMV office, go through the paperwork, and get your eyes checked is just one more small thing that could save a life on a highway. And I think it's worth doing. I am not picking on old people. We already pick on young people in driving. I consider driving a privilege, not a right. And I'm going to be old myself. And in fact, according to my children, already am. And so I think this is a reasonable piece. Now, ODOT has some other amendments that they'd like us to consider around how to stage this. And I would certainly be open to those kinds of amendments, along with an amendment to take out that test. But I really appreciate your indulgence in hearing this bill, and I hope you will understand where I'm coming from better when you hear from my constituent, Ms. Groh. Thank you.
Before she leaves, does anyone have any questions? No, you're getting off. Okay, and I am going to now close the public hearing on this, and we'll resume that after our next bill. So my apologies to those who've come on that bill. We'll get back to it. And I am going to open the work session on House Bill 2278.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2278 is the measure that authorizes the issuance of lottery bonds up to $100 million plus an additional amount established by the State Treasurer to pay bond-related costs for transportation projects funded from the Multimodal Transportation Fund. The measure also has an emergency clause attached to it. We do have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. You have at your seat at the dais the Dash 2 amendments, as well as a Hahn and Gross version of those. The Dash 2 amendments add rulemaking authority to the Oregon Transportation Commission by specifying that to the extent that proposed transportation projects meet the qualifications established by the Oregon Transportation Commission by rule, so there's an increase in rulemaking authority, the commission shall allocate, and here's another change, it reduces from 15% to 10% the allocation of the net lottery proceeds to each region. The Dash 2 amendments also direct the Commission to solicit recommendations from the Economic and Community Development Department prior to selecting marine projects. Finally, the Dash 2 amendments add qualifications for the Commission to consider in selecting transportation projects, and those additions include that the project improves access to jobs and sources of labor, that the project results in economic benefit to the state, and that the project connects elements of Oregon's transportation system. The amendment also further clarifies that matching funds may come from any source. Finally, the Dash 2 amendments delete qualifications for the commission to consider, and that is deleting language that relates to benefiting or connecting two or more modes of transportation. That is the substitute language there is that it connects elements of Oregon's transportation system. We're removing language that says creates construction and permanent jobs in this state. And it also removes a reference to statewide or regional projects. Instead, again, we're adding the language regarding those connecting elements in Oregon's transportation system. Again, this does have subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I am, if anyone has any questions about that, I was going to go ahead and invite up Matt Garrett and Chris Warner and Stuart Foster. Gentlemen, who wants to go first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stuart Foster, Chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission. I want to thank the committee for moving this bill at the speed that it's moving it. It is an extremely important bill that allows us to fund intermodal projects on a second round from Connect Oregon 1, which was a huge benefit to the non-highway transportation system of the state. And there are a lot of very important projects out there that will come before us. I've had a chance to review the proposed amendments to the bill, and I think they're all excellent amendments. And as someone who worked intimately with the bill, with the last Connect Oregon bill, this is a bill that we can work with and deliver again the kind of success that we delivered in the past. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can go ahead.
I thank Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matthew Garrett, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I echo what Chairman Foster said, but more importantly, I want to thank you, Chairman Byron, Representative Gilman, as well as Senators Johnson and Metzger, for your vision and leadership. You have moved this forward. I've also had the opportunity to look over the Dash 2s, and we at the agency are comfortable. So thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Warner from the Governor's Office. Thank you for all the work you've done on this. Certainly one of the things as the work group and the folks that worked on this when we got together, I mean, what our goal was to make sure that the projects that we funded, no matter where they were in the state, were good projects and move forward the economic development and the transportation system of the state. And we think the amendments do that. And I just wanted to thank you for doing that. But certainly what we were focused on, and I think the message that we heard from Representative Tomei especially, is in terms of accountability and projects that really do move the ball forward. And so in that sense, we do support the amendment. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Butler.
It was kind of a combination of our names, so, but I that's fine.
Mumble.
Thank you very much. I wonder if any of these three folks, where they're the certified smart people from the inside there, as the chair of the commission and Matt Garrett and the governor's policy person, Chris Warner, I wonder if any of you would talk to this issue of the most recent iteration that says 10% versus 15%. I'm very concerned about that. I'm anxious that we're going to pit basically with five regions, we're going to put 50% of this total resource, and that's going to pit the rest of the state against some folks that want that for some light rail issues in the metropolitan area. Now, I'm not sure how you get your cattle to market in Portland, but I know we don't use light rail in eastern Oregon. So I need an explanation why 15% goes away and why 10% is better.
Madam Chair, Member Butler, one of the concerns that I had, after we went through the last process had to do with the 15% and as it applied to the region I'm from, Region 3. We funded, the commission funded $16 million worth of projects in Region 3, which is 16%. One of those projects was $7.7 million, a rail project. If that project had fallen off the table, we would have had a major, major problem in finding credible projects to make up enough to cover that 15%. I mean, it was a real heartburn for me thinking, you know, if that happened, we would have had to look at some projects that none of us would have been happy of getting funded. My sense is that And also talking about that process, we had the light rail region, the eastern Oregon and southern Oregon, and in Willamette Valley, all fair. Well, not necessarily Southern Oregon, but Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, and Willamette Valley all fared substantially better than the 15% figure. I think Region 5 was, 22%. And the reason why they fared better is that they had good projects. They had projects that could compete against any project that came out of any metropolitan area. So my sense is that by reducing the percentage down to 10%, we avoid, and I know there is some moderating language in here, but it clearly avoids us getting ourselves into a real bind if we have a situation where an area cannot come up with credible projects. An area comes up, I don't care where it is in the state, my sense is an area comes up with good, credible projects that meet this criteria, it's going to compete. And nobody, the last round, nobody said, at least I didn't sit there and go, okay, we got 10% in Southern Oregon, we need to dig up another 2%. I think in the consensus committee, we were all looking at what are good projects, what projects are in the best interest of the state of Oregon. And as a result of that, we came out with what was an interesting array, and as I say, well above the 15% in areas that you might think otherwise. So I think it's going to work. We'll work hard to make it work. And the other thing is that we believe very strongly in regional equity. So if there are good projects out there, they're going to get funded.
Just follow up if I may. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Foster. I guess that the concern that I would express now, that was 2 years ago. This is today. Those folks now have the idea of how to do this, recognize how to go through the process. I'm sorry, but I don't, as I fish around Oregon, I don't see that there's a dearth of programs that should qualify that folks now would like to see funded. For that reason, I'm still very anxious about dropping $5 million per region. Now, your regional fair fine, my regional fair fine in Region 5 with Mike Nelson there, I think he'll be a tremendous advocate that it'll be fair. My concern is we won't always have you in Region 3. We won't always have Mike Nelson in Region 5. For that reason, I'm anxious about the 10% versus the 15%. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know Representative Buckley had a question, but I did want to address that a little bit in that, I mean, this is the second round, and I'm really excited that we're doing this. I like the investment we're making into multimodal, if I could say the word. But I don't know how long we're going to do this, so I'm not sure whether the concern about who's going to be there. I think everybody who is involved in transportation shares the same concerns about quality projects, about fairness, and about the process. And I think that if they don't, hopefully they're not going to be appointed into these positions that affect the state so much. So that's where my concern is. I also want to point out that this is definitely a floor that we're looking at. We are not looking at a cap. I mean, there is still another $50 million out there that can go anywhere in the state that can do and put together a good project. And I think that's one of the things that we have to keep in mind. Plus, it was such a short time frame getting it going last time that people didn't have the time to put into developing those projects, and they've had much longer, actually, to do that. I mean, they're working on these projects now, and we're going to see, actually, a lot more projects submitted this time than in the past. So, and I think we're going to see really good ones all over the state. So, Representative Butler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, first of all, I just want to thank whoever is responsible for the amendment page 2, section 3, subsection 3A, that adds improves access to jobs and sources of labor. I think that's an outstanding addition. Thanks to whoever pushed that forward. I would just, as part of this conversation, do you anticipate the consensus committee to be made up of the same, perhaps maybe not the same individuals, maybe comment on that, but basically the same sort of representation as in Connect Oregon number 1?
Madam Chair, Committee Member Buckley, Yeah, one of the things that we thought worked very well with consensus committee, which is counterintuitive. Number one, it was very large, 30, I think, and it was extremely diverse. And then the other thing that was critical is that we locked them in a room for 2 days. It worked well. I think it's a tool that worked well, and would be really mistake. We really wouldn't be smart to change it. I certainly am an advocate of that process. And what was really interesting is that when we went through that, we went into that room and we asked everybody to forget about where they were from, what region they were from, what industry they represented, but to think about the fact that they were Oregonians. And we wanted them to act as stewards of the system and to make their judgment based on what was best for Oregon. And I think over that two-day process, that really worked. Sure, we still had individuals who were advocates, but we had people, there were folks there that agreed to defer their projects, which were good projects, in favor of moving another one forward. So, you get real nervous trying to replicate the success you had in the past, but on the other hand, I think it'd be a real mistake if we tried to change it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And no other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. And I now want to ask Art Schlack if he would like to come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. As you know, several days ago, I spoke in favor of House Bill 2278 and urged its passing. Part of that was the fact that there was 15% regional allocation in the document, and we are very much a supporter of regional equity or regional distribution of funds, and supported 15%. I am, shall we say, uncomfortable or disappointed with the idea that the allocation is being reduced to 10% rather than retaining the 15%. My comfort level could be increased with the words that were issued a couple of minutes ago by the chair, indicating that the 10% is a floor, not a cap. From my experience going through Connect Oregon 1, the 15% was viewed as a cap, not as a floor. And I think legislative intent should certainly clarify, if you go with the 10%, that it is a floor, and that a region may get or may have funds exceeding the 10% if the projects that they have warrant that, and that you're not looking at now a $100 million pot with $50 million in, as a statewide allocation, and you know you have a cap on the five regions of the state. Other than that, Madam Chair, I am comfortable, as you know, with the amendments that you have before you. And thank you for an opportunity to let the committee know how the Association of Oregon Counties views the proposed amendments.
Thank you, and thank you for your participation and help in the process. I appreciate it. And I do want to point out that the language does say at least 10%. So I think that's a pretty good directive. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I understand it, because I think there's actually a correction that needs to be made. In the last biennium's legislation, the 15% was a floor because there was a 25% pool, if you would, for regions that had extraordinary needs or special projects, or the department saw a need to add money into a region. And so while every region of the state got 15% as the floor, there was a potential for a region, say a region with the Port of Portland, to garner additional dollars. And so I'm not sure that 15% was the cap, but was the floor.
Madam Chair, do we have the actual appropriation of how the last multimodal money went out and what the actual distribution was? I guess I still remain concerned that we can talk about 10% of the floor. My concern is that may leave one of the regions getting $60 million or two of the regions getting $70 million, the other three each getting $10 million and saying, well, that's the floor. So I am concerned about that.
Thank you. We have someone with some information that can share with us here.
Chair by Representative Butler, since my math skills are limited, since there's $100 million, if it says $27 million, I'm assuming that's 27%. For Region 1, 19 for Region 2, 16 for Region 3, 17 for Region 4, and 16 for Region 5.
Madam Chair, I'm just about ready to rest my case. Two very populated, the most populated sections of our state, in this particular instance, garnered 46%. And that what that does is that by putting a new lower floor on those that got 16, 17, and 16, putting a new lower floor of $10 million on those folks, is that we will then spread the remaining portion amongst the other regions. I'm just very concerned about that. Again, Madam Chair, by your own discussion, the regions now have an opportunity to have examined for 2 years longer the opportunity to get into the multimodal program, and it's time for us now to recognize those folks. If I just can't imagine that they're not going to be able to come forward with the projects, because I know in my Region 5 in southeastern and southeastern Oregon, those folks have worked long and hard to figure out what multimodal items they'll be able to address with the anticipation of the money. And I would like to honor the concerns that Art Schlack has presented to us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm probably in the minority in my caucus on this issue, and I accept that. And Representative Butler and Representative Gilman probably won't appreciate my comments. My perspective on this allocation has always been that the money needs to go where it's best spent and where the greatest investment can be made and where the greatest bang for the buck is going to be made in terms of moving freight efficiently and safely. And as a rural Eastern Oregon citizen and as a legislator, and a person who deals extensively in the movement of freight with companies that deal in this industry, I would share with everyone what's good for the Port of Portland is good for all of us. And if $100 million was spent on the Port of Portland out of Connect Oregon dollars, it's going to benefit the Port of Morrow. It's going to benefit the Port of Umatilla. It's going to benefit the folks in Ontario. It's going to benefit the folks in Prineville. It's going to benefit the folks in Milwaukee, Ashland,
Beaverton.
And so it's a nice problem to have. I mean, for the last 6 to 8 years being in this building, we've always squibbled over not having enough money. Now it seems like we're squibbling on how to spend excess dollars. And I guess I would just say we need to allocate those dollars and give discretion to the department to spread those dollars where they think the best bang for the buck will be met in moving products safely and efficiently.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Save me from having to say it. I appreciate it. Thank you. I appreciate that. And do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2278.
Representative Tomei moves the -2 amendments dated 2-2107 to House Bill 2278.
Madam Chair, just very quickly, I have a conflict of interest with this piece of legislation as my company works with individuals who make application. I don't personally make application. Would you like me to declare that conflict now or when we vote on the final bill? How would you like that?
How about the final bill?
All right, I'll wait.
Now that you've done it once, we'll do it again.
All right. I just want to make sure I get that on the record so everyone knows that I do work with companies that will
Thank
make
you.
Applications.
Any other discussion?
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we had a work group that worked on this bill for at least three times that I remember going to meetings. And although I was not in attendance the full duration of the time, if I recall, there was only one individual that made a comment about advocating for 10%. Except this is what's happened in this bill. And it was definitely not the consensus of that work group. I think we even took a vote, and it was not evident at that time. So I will be voting no on this amendment. And all the other pieces are fine. It's the 15% that gives me heartburn.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. I do want to say, having ran the work group for three meetings, the work group worked very hard, came together really very well on the language of this. It appeared, though, during this process that the biggest issues out there were the process and the rules. And we seemed to keep wanting to go back to that issue as opposed to the actual bill. I think everybody was pretty much okay with the language that was ironed out. So at this point, there is going to be a technical group that is going to work on, after our work is done with this bill, to work on the procedures and the rules to implement Connect Oregon. And Robin Freeman at ODOT is the person to contact if you want to participate in that. And the discussions on the percentages, while in the vote we did take, more people actually voted for 15% than voted for 10%, but over half of the group had no opinion at all. So it's not like we were disregarding the requests of the group. They liked Connect Oregon. They wanted to see this happen, and did not express an opinion. So I do want to make that clear that it wasn't that we overrode a big group of people. People think this project is important, and the good it'll do the state is important. So they just wanted to get on with it. And any other comments?
I just had a question, Madam Chair. Could you identify where the people are from that want to move the rate to 10% versus 15%? Maybe identify which of the regions they might have represented in that process. As long as we know where they're at and know where the money's going to go, I guess I can vote no in peace at that particular point. But if this is a political payoff, I'd like that to be on the record too.
No, there's no political payoff. Basically, I would say it's probably the biggest push on this is the not Portland, but south of Portland, the outside the metro area.
Yeah, the folks who got 27% last time.
No. So, anyway, we have a motion on the table. So, all those of the opinion that the Dash 2 amendments of House Bill 2278 dated 2-21-07 should be adopted. We'll vote aye, and those opposed, no, and the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
No.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. We moved on. the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2278 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with the DuPass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2278 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill will be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
Madam Chair and colleagues, I need to declare a conflict of interest as I do work with entities that anticipate making application for Connect Oregon, and so I want to get that on the record for all of you to know.
So noted. No other comments? All of those of the opinion, House Bill 2278. No, I've done that. Haven't I? Oh, no. I'm still not doing this enough. Should be reported to the floor as amended. Should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill referred to the Ways and Means by prior reference will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Madam Chair, point of order. Does this go to Ways and Means, or is this going to the floor?
This goes to Ways and Means.
Okay. So it doesn't go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It goes to Ways and Means.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The language, the formal language, the parliamentary
motion. To the floor.
Hmm. Yeah.
And referred. So, thank you. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
No.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. The motion passes. And thank you, everybody.
Step one.
Yes. Yeah. And I close the work session on House Bill 2278. And we're going to open the public hearing on 2639. Jack Evans and Tom McClellan, you come up.
Opportunity here. Since we got you over here on the left side of the dais.
Okay, thanks.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I am Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and with me is Tom McClellan, the DMV's Program Services Manager, and we're here today to talk to House Bill 2639. As Representative Berger mentioned earlier, the intent of this legislation is to ensure that the department evaluate drivers that are 75 years of age and older on a more frequent basis to ensure that their ability to drive safely is still intact. Currently, this population, or the population that are over 71 in Oregon, who are licensed drivers, accounts for 268,000 individuals. And just for your information, this group of individuals over 71 who are licensed, 5,100 of them have valid CDLs, and 8,900 of them have motorcycle endorsements. At this point in time in Oregon, all driver's licenses expire in 8 years. Those over 50 years of age must have an eye exam every time they renew their driver's license. And in 2006, there were 94 individuals that were in the age group of 75 and older who failed their vision examination and had their license suspended pending getting their eyes corrected or a report from their physician. What this bill would do would be require a 4-year renewal and testing for drivers that are 75 years and older. Individuals between 72 and 75 years old would receive a license that expires on their 79th birthday. And what that does is that creates 4 distinct renewal periods for individuals in this group of 4, 5, 6, and 7 years. And it's that aspect of the bill that staggering of the licenses that presents a challenge to DMV and drives the fiscal impact of the bill. We're estimating that this would be a major IT project at this time to undertake. We would need to prorate renewals and test fees. We would need to code for these varied validity periods for the licenses. And then we'd also be required to increase the FTE over the period of time to run these drive tests. We are anticipating expenses after everyone is phased in to be about $2 million a biennium as a result of this. And because of the other major IT projects that are underway, we would anticipate that we could implement this by January 1st of 2009. When Representative Berger was here, she mentioned the possibility of having some amendments to this, and we discussed it with her to look at some things that might make this more feasible. And I'll just talk about a couple of them that would work. She had mentioned the notion of requiring only an eye examination rather than the skills driving test. This would have a significant impact on ongoing costs because the number of people that you'd have to bring on over the years to run these tests would be dramatically cut, because instead of a 25-30 minute drive test, you'd have a 2 or 3 minute eye exam. So that would have a significant impact. The other would be to, rather than have this staggered period of renewals for licenses, which drives the major impact on the IT system, if you just had an individual renew and pass the test every 4 years on or after their 75th birthday, that'd cut those initial implementation costs by about $500,000. So if you decide this is a good way to go with this measure, we think that the proponents are willing to entertain these concepts to make the bill more workable, and we're certainly willing to work with them on that. And Tom McClellan is here to talk about an existing program that Representative Berger also alluded to, which is the at-risk driver program, which we feel is a very successful program. And if you have questions for me, I will answer them at this point, or I can turn it over to Tom.
Any questions?
Quick clarification.
Okay.
Just so I'm clear. Thank you. I'm sorry. 94 drivers out of 268,000 were suspended.
Actually, Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, that's 94 drivers in the age 75 and older were suspended, and I'm not sure the exact number of drivers in that category, because the 268,000 is a little bit bigger group. That's 71 years of age and older, and these statistics are just for the ones 75 and older. We were able to pull the stats for the 71 plus drivers out there, but for this, the number of suspensions, we just looked at the ones that were affected by this bill.
So if you just divide, using very rough numbers, that 94 by 268,000, that works out to 0.0003%.
It's a small percentage, Representative, that's right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm with Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division, Department of Transportation. I was asked to give just a quick overview of our existing medically at-risk driver program, just so you had a little bit of that background as you're considering this bill. It's a fairly new program, so we thought we wanted to cover that for you. The purpose of the program is to address drivers who may no longer be safe to drive as a result of a medical condition or impairment. It has four major components. It has a mandatory reporting piece, voluntary reporting, self-reporting, and a vision screening process that we were just talking about as part of the driver licensing process. It goes back to 1999 when the legislature directed DMV to do a study on the effects of aging on the ability to drive. We convened an older driver advisory committee with many people as part of that, that group. The conclusion of that committee was that age alone and or the presence of various medical conditions does not support the conclusion that a driver lacks the fitness to drive. That just because you're old doesn't mean you're not able to drive. They recommended revising the list of medical conditions, which must be reported, to reflect the range of conditions that affect driving behavior so that it would include cognitive and functional impairments. In 2001, House Bill 3071 was signed into law. It's now Statute 807710. What was new was that it was impairment-based determinations. What was dropped or not as heavily emphasized was the loss of consciousness and condition or a diagnose-based determination. In 2002, we convened a medical work group. They helped us to draft administrative rules that designated which physicians and healthcare providers would be required to report to DMV, and they designated cognitive and functional impairments that are likely to affect a person's ability to safely operate a motor vehicle. In 2003, there were further modifications to the law dealing with civil immunity and confidentiality of records at the request of the medical community. Those 2003 revisions, a designated physician or a healthcare provider who makes a report or does not make a report is immune from civil liability that may otherwise result. And then on the confidentiality side, the DMV is considered a public health authority, so that medical information required by the department is confidential and shall be used only to determine qualifications of a person to drive. Consequently, the release of the confidential medical information is not in conflict with the HIPAA regulations. So there's confidentiality is protected. In June of 2004, we completed the statewide implementation of this program. It was phased in over several months across the state. It replaced the previous program that was there. Today, what must be reported is from a designated physician or a healthcare provider, they must report those persons with severe and uncontrollable cognitive or functional impairments affecting the person's ability to safely operate a motor vehicle. And that comes from their primary care providers. The impairments that are reported on the functional side, they're obviously vision, peripheral sensation, strength, flexibility, motor skills, coordination. On the cognitive side, attention, judgment and problem solving, reaction time, impulsivity, something called visuospatial, memory, and loss of consciousness or control. Those are all on the cognitive side. The decision criteria that we use on mandatory reports is that we ensure that the proper form has been filled out, but also that the report includes severe and uncontrollable impairments that's been submitted by a mandatory reporter, that it describes how the impairment affects the person, and it contains applicable underlying diagnosis or conditions, so the patient's identifying information and the reporter's identifying information, and handled by our office with the assistance of the state health officer. The consequences of that reporting, just looking at calendar year 2006 on the mandatory reports, we received over 1,550 reports. The age of the persons reported ranged from age 15 to 95, with 56% of those individuals age 70 or above. The suspensions that resulted, 81% involved cognitive impairments, such as judgment, reaction time, memory, and attention. 16% involved vision only, and fewer than 13% regained their driving privileges. That's the mandatory program. We also have a voluntary program that involves medical professionals, pharmacists, social service providers, law enforcement, courts, family, friends, whoever might report a concern about someone's driving. And those are medical conditions or a diagnosis and observed driving behaviors, and those are submitted on a driver evaluation request form to our office. The criteria is similar and is outlined in administrative rules. We ensure that sufficient information has been provided to believe that the medical condition affects the person's ability to drive safely. Our potential actions include possibly an immediate suspension, additional medical information, or mandatory testing of the individual, which includes vision, knowledge, and behind-the-wheel tests. Similar process in handling those, and we do consult again with the state health officer for medical advice. During 2006, on the voluntary program, we received over 3,900 reports. 32% of those were for people of age 75 or above. 46% of those were self-reports, and many of those were from the driver license application where they answer some medical questions as part of that process. 27% came from the police, 15% were from medical providers, and 12% were from other people like family and friends. Most of these resulted in some kind of retesting, and the majority of these people were able to retain or regain their driving privileges by proving their ability to operate the vehicle.
Thank you. Questions?
Question, Tom.
Butler?
Tom, how does this voluntary program in 2006 work when you get 3,900 reports and let's say that the court calls in and says, I don't think that Mrs. Jones is really capable of continuing on with her driver's license. Do you folks go down and gather up Mrs. Jones, or do you send her a letter, or what happens there?
Madam Chair, President Butler, we would contact the individual and ask for additional medical information. We might, depending on the information that's provided to us, we might require some additional testing, a vision test, a knowledge test, and a behind-the-wheel test. If it appeared that there was a severe problem, we might consult with the state health officer as well on the medical condition that's described to see if we'd be safe to be in the car with her to do that drive test.
So if I can just follow up. So 3,900 cases, you sent out letters, you actually have ended up seeing all 3,900 of them, it's assumed, and of those, the majority did retain their driving privileges, according to your information here. Who bears the cost of that work with the 3,900 and eventually the couple thousand of them that would have that would retest and actually retain their licenses? Is there an additional cost to the person that's been referred?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, there would be retesting charges, cost for that person as well. The program itself is covered by the department's operating budget to run the medical program, both mandatory and voluntary. So our staff time.
So if I can just follow up. So if someone calls in and says, I don't think Widow Jones is capable of driving her car anymore, then she's called in with the letter, and then she bears all of the cost of retesting and so forth.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, there would be some costs associated with that, yes, for the individual.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's curious to me that there were 3,900 voluntary reports and only 1,500 mandatory reports. And one would hope that if someone were impaired that their physician would report them, but maybe that isn't the case?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, sometimes it's situational, too. When the person goes in to visit their primary care provider, they may be fine at that time, but then they have some other impairment that takes place after that, observed by a police officer or another driver, and then that's when it's reported to us. Then we follow up at that point.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the voluntary program, it would seem if 46%, I know this is just for one year, but if 46% self-report, that would indicate that the prospect of having folks return to renew their license every 4 years might result in additional self-reporting that would help alleviate this problem.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that is possible. Many of the people who fill out that form, though, on the medical don't realize until after they've filled it out that it means they might not get their license, and they sometimes recant their previous report. But, yes, that is possible. The more frequently we see them, the more likely that they might indicate they have a medical problem.
Just to follow, Madam Chair, my grandmother caused a minor scandal with the DMV in San Francisco, California by trying to bribe the DMV official after he informed her that she had self-reported and her license was going to be removed from her.
Chip cookies.
Drop 20
bucks.
Oh, 20 bucks. Representative
Reed. Madam Chair, that's a tough act to follow. My apologies for being out briefly. Maybe you already answered this question, but amongst the other category, other reporting, are there provisions or processes for determining whether somebody's just mad at their neighbor and trying to make that an issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Reed, we have looked into that, and there are very, very few cases of that where we believe someone is just a bit vindictive about their neighbor. Those are pretty rare that we get those cases. And it has to be a good description of a particular problem and credible in that report. So as we follow up, if we determine that that's not the case, we will not pursue those. And many of those that are dropped that are voluntary because we don't feel there's enough evidence to indicate the person has a problem.
Your neighbor being ugly won't work.
I don't think that works.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative
Butler. I want to do so quietly in my sleep like my dad, not like the horrified screaming and crying passengers in his car.
Thank you,
One quick question, and I think it might have been there in the HIPAA information, but now it's my understanding that they won't take an anonymous report on a driver, but they will not release the name of the person who makes the report. Is that correct, or am I?
Madam Chair, we do maintain the confidentiality of the individual that submits the report, but they need to indicate to us who they are. So you're right, an anonymous report would not be accepted, but we would protect the individual's identity if there was a question about, well, who did report me? Yeah. So yes, you are correct.
Thank you. And colleagues, in case you get one of these, they won't release that information to you either. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And colleagues, I perhaps am in the minority on this. I feel like Oregon drivers are under attack in this building this session. We're all sharing our personal anecdotes. I mean, my mother and father, early 70s, my dad's an eagle eye. He's got better vision than I do. Mm-hmm. And so I struggle with legislation that's going to penalize Oregonians without cause. And I think there's genuine good intent with this legislation, but I just don't understand why we're attacking drivers throughout the state this session. That's my two cents.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you.
One more, Madam Chair, for Jack.
Sorry.
Because Representative Smith does bring up a very good point. Jack, do you have any stats in terms of accidents, involvement in accidents of drivers over the age of 75?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, we don't have any with us, but we can certainly pull something together, transportation safety, and keep statistics, and we can put a report together for you.
Thank you. Actually, the worst drivers are the younger drivers is what you're going to find.
Right.
If you went by statistics based upon age, you'd kick the kids out until they were 30.
That's the next bill.
Representative Reed's looking worried now.
All right. I'm going to get control now here. Thank you. That was a very good question. I look forward to that information. Katie Groh.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kate Groh, and I'd like to introduce my grandchildren, my grandsons, Jordan, age 7, Joey, age 6, and baby Alex, 6 weeks old. They can't be here because they were all killed in a car accident 5 years ago, an 83-year-old man hit our daughter's car head-on on Wallace Road 2 days after Thanksgiving. And our daughter was put in the hospital. She was in a coma for over a week. By the time she came out of the coma, the boys were buried before she even knew that they were gone. The 83-year-old man also died in the accident. He had had five other chargeable accidents in the 9 years previous to the accident that killed our grandchildren and himself. Since this has torn apart our family over the last 5 years, and things are starting to get better, and we can usually talk about it without bursting into tears now, I decided that something needed to be done. And so I spoke with Senator Durfler in early 2002, and I've been back every 2 years since then. And I'm very appreciative of the time that you're giving this afternoon, because I'm so happy that Representative Berger was actually able to at least get us a hearing on this, because I've been working on it for such a long time and will continue to do so if we don't pass it this session. Over the years now, I've gone back to school. I've gotten a bachelor's degree. I'm working on a master's in social work now. I've done a lot of research in this area. And Jack from ODOT was talking about the numbers about the people between 71 and 75. The number for over 75 up to 105 in Oregon licensed drivers is 188,000. And while 94 people might not seem like very much, it seems like a lot to the 94 families that are involved if those people have an accident. We have a population of elderly people over age 65 that contributes about 13% of our population. They contribute 13 to 14% of the accidents that are fatalities. They contribute 18% of the accidents that involve pedestrians that are fatalities. Okay, we all are aging. Just like Representative Berger said, I'm the same way. I'm 52 years old. I hope when I'm 75, I'm terrific behind the wheel. But if I'm not, then I want there to be things in place. And while I also agree that the program that they have in place now is a good program, and actually our daughter, after her accident, was caught up in that because her doctor reported that one of the many surgeries she had after the accident was a heart surgery, and so she did not drive for a year after that accident. And so the program, I think, works, but I don't think that that's really what we're dissecting. I think that asking for elderly drivers to come in every 4 years is not punitive. I think that it puts us in line with what the rest of the United States is doing. I've attached a copy of a state-by-state analysis of what other states are doing, and you'll find that Oregon ranks 49th out of 50. The only state that does less than Oregon is Wisconsin. And I say less than Oregon because the only thing that we do here is an eye test every 8 years. And that's just simply not enough. As I've gone around this building and through these halls over the years testifying and lobbying for this bill, I've heard multitudes of stories from almost everybody, staff people, representatives. Everybody has a story about, my Uncle Tony shouldn't be behind the wheel anymore. You know, and I understand that, but there's a real personal element here where none of us want to be the one that has to take grandma's keys away from her. Nobody wants to be the one to get written out of the will. And so it's something where people don't like to talk about it. And this takes it out of the hands of the family members, and it's just another protection. Having people come in every 4 years. It should be nonpartisan. It's non-punitive. The bill addresses the fee structure so that everything is adjusted so that nobody pays more because they're coming in oftener. Everything will be prorated so that they'll just be paying the same amount but cut in half, which would, for a four-year period, be about $27 now rather than the $54.50 that it costs to get a driver license now. I've also addressed the issue where one of the things that I hear every time I talk about this is that the younger drivers cause more accidents, and that's true. They do. But we've done a lot in Oregon. We've done a really good job of putting in place stop gaps for those younger drivers. We're not asking for drivers over 75 to ride with another licensed driver in the car for 20 or 30 hours like our young people are having to do now. We're not asking them to take driver training. We're simply asking to come in and be tested a little oftener and have a renewal cycle this every 4 years, which, again, is in line with what most of the other states do. I'm also often asked the questions about, well, what about the rural counties? What about the places where here in Salem we have terrific rapid transit, and we're lumped in with Polk County here in Marion County, and some of the Portland metro areas also are kind of together under the same small transportation systems for seniors. I've also attached a list on the main packet that tells which counties are getting how much federal money and how much state money. That money is already in place. The counties are already receiving the funding to provide alternative transportation for senior drivers. And we're not saying nobody over 75 can drive anymore, find a small bus or an alternative. We're just saying come in and get checked a little oftener. Okay. There's also a handout that tells which agencies in which counties are receiving how much money. So that makes it a little more specific. The money is out there, and it's already going to the counties. They're getting it and spending it now. I can't speak to some of the rural counties because I'm not in there, but I know that Polk County, where I live, that links in with Marion County, we have a good system in place here. So anybody have any questions?
Thank you. Questions, Representative Buck.
Just a comment. I really appreciate you bringing forth your testimony. I'm very sorry for your loss. You know, the information you provided on the transit funding for seniors and individuals with disabilities, I think we're doing a horrible job. In my county of Jackson, we cut services to the medical center, Rogue Valley Medical Center, so seniors right now have no way to get to the medical centers unless they try to drive themselves. You bring up an excellent point. We've got to give more options to people so they don't try to drive when it's unsafe for them to do so. So I appreciate bringing that forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Katie, for sharing your story. Kate, I'm looking at your list, and where you've listed Oregon as dead last or next to the last, I'm looking down that list. Tell me what makes Oregon... When I look at Oregon on the list, it says Oregon does have other provisions. Visual screening is required every 8 years for drivers 50 and older.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look, just go up to Oklahoma, it has no restrictions that are safety related, none for Ohio, none for North Dakota. As a matter of fact, I count about 25 of the states that have absolutely no restrictions that are safety related. Whereas Oregon does have the visual screening. Help me with that, please.
But the length of the renewal cycle is shorter in all those other states.
Okay, may I follow up? Thank you. I see that in some states they actually will go for a shorter period of time.
Right.
But there is absolutely no restriction, so basically it's costing them a 39 or 41 cent stamp on a four-year basis versus on an eight-year basis. So if I look at Oregon, Oregon is actually more restrictive than some of the other states, but when I look at that, one of the things that they do to restrict that is, for instance, Alaska says the mail renewal is not available for people 69 and older. Maybe that's and if that's considered more restrictive, that we're going to see you in person in our shop every 4 years, because I see Idaho encourages them to come in after 4 years. Mm-hmm. But if that's considered more restrictive, but I don't know that 4 years versus 6 years versus 8 years is necessarily safer in those states. But I'm looking at Oregon, and Oregon actually has a provision which is not required in any of those states that you're saying are much safer than Oregon, because they don't have any kind of visual testing for people, even on an eight-year basis. They don't do it ever.
I'm talking specifically about the length of that renewal cycle.
Okay.
Like was stated before, the fact that they're walking in and filling out the paperwork and being observed by the staff may lead to some more people self-reporting. Okay. 8 years is a very long time. Whoever it was that said somebody went in at 92 years old and said, I'm good till 100. Okay, that's a long time. And with elderly people, a lot of medical issues can arise during an eight-year period. And they may not all be caught by the other program.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. Representative Berger, in working with DMV, was considering some amendments that would drop the testing requirement, and I'm curious that if this bill went forward without that in it, what was your comfort level with that?
My comfort level is very good with that. Over the years that I've been here trying to move this forward, I've come to the realization that you can't always get everything you want. But this is, I think, a good, it's great to be able to have everybody come in every 4 years. I think that's a good place to have it.
And
without the driving test, I think that that's fine. And I agree, it would be a lot of money.
So, and then just a quick follow-up on that is, do you think you would be inclined to come back? Or would that take care of it
that
for
satisfy
you?
Me?
Yeah.
It would probably satisfy me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you had conversation with ARP on this issue, and what is their input?
Actually, I spoke to a reporter today who said that he had spoken with the ARP people, and I've not had a personal conversation with them. They thought that it was discriminatory, according to what the reporter said. But, and I think that ARP does a terrific job doing the driving programs that they do, but a lot of those are so that we can get less on our insurance rates. I mean, that's why we go to the 55 Alive classes, you know, and soon I'll be able to go too and get less on my insurance, which would be great.
Okay. No other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your coming in and hearing your story. And if
you
want to hang around,
much.
You can actually hear what ARP has to say, since Rick Bennett with ARP is here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. Yes, we have some concerns about the bill, and we have concerns about any legislation that uses an arbitrary age to accomplish something. Certainly, Mrs. Groh's testimony and the story related to her daughter and her grandchildren, it is tragic. Frankly, I'm concerned anytime I read a story related to a driving accident and individuals are maimed or killed, but that accident may involve a younger person who perhaps was driving aggressive or someone else who was drinking, and this bill isn't going to change that. I'm not going to read my testimony word for word. Let me just hit a few points here. Let me tell you what AARP does support. We support routine in-person renewal, screening, and testing that focuses on an individual's ability to drive through their lives. We believe that older drivers are relatively safe, and I think most national studies will back that up. We're very supportive of Oregon's medically at-risk driver program. Again, it's not age-related. It's related to an individual's functional and cognitive abilities and whether or not some of those may impair that person and make them unable to drive safely. And again, this is not related to age, but related to actual skills related to that they need to drive safely. I think that statistics that DMV provided, I think, show that that program is working and working well. Not only in the mandatory program where physicians and other health care providers are mandated to report individuals who meet the criteria, and I believe the Oregon Medical Association and other health care provider associations are good about providing information to educate their members regarding this program and what the physicians and other health care providers should be looking for and what they do need, they must report to DMV. I think the voluntary program is excellent as well, where indeed law enforcement and the courts and friends and families and so forth can also voluntarily report individuals who they think perhaps are no longer able to drive safely. In California, I know that we're supportive of this pilot program, and let me just briefly describe it to you. California's DMV has developed and pilot tested a three-tier assessment for driver's license renewal for applicants of all ages. The first two tiers consist of a set of in-person at the DMV assessment tools, such as driving knowledge tests, cognitive screening, vision tests, and observation for obvious physical impairments. Applicants failing both tiers must then pass a road test to renew their license. Now, this is done, I believe, on a regular basis, regardless of age. The pilot program found that lower assessment scores in the first two tiers were related to poor performance on the road test, but were not consistently related to crash records 3 years prior to renewal. No relationship to any crash history as a part of the person's driving record. Our ARP's driver safety program was mentioned, and actually because
can
a few
I,
years...
We have a question here, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rick, as I go down the list that was provided to us, which obviously came off of an Internet site, it mentions California. It shows a number of states. For instance, I'm just pulling out Louisiana. Louisiana has a four-year renewal program. But after age 70, they require the people to actually come in and present themselves. And we've heard testimony today from the DMV and their safety folks saying, wait a minute, we've got a self-report, we've got a self-assessment, self-reporting, we've got a third-party assessment, third-party reporting, and here's another way, an actual not mailing out the renewals, but having those folks actually come in and presenting themselves, and I think there's probably seven or eight states that actually do that, that move from the, and incidentally, those states don't show that they have the self-reporting and third-party reporting that Oregon has, and it also does not, none of those states show that they have the mandatory vision screening that Oregon has. Would AARP be perhaps supportive of having those folks show up for their renewals in person as opposed to having them mailed?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, we're supportive of any type of in-person renewal and so forth as long as everyone is treated the same way, regardless of age.
Thank you.
And frankly, as I said, to treat somebody age 75 differently than somebody age 74 or age 65 or age 45 is a concern to us. Our driver safety program was mentioned. A few years ago, we changed our membership from age 55 to age 50, so the program is no longer covered live at 55. But it's probably the first and the largest refresher course for those 50-plus in the country. Over 10 million people have gone through that program. I've gone through the program. And, yes, I did receive a discount on my insurance as well, but I also got a number of good tips that I use every day driving down here from Portland. And as Representative Berger was saying, that, yes, our skills perhaps are not quite as good as they were when we were 25 or 30 or so forth. And with any particular activity, we compensate for that in different ways. And our driver safety program is about educating people to new changes in the law. It's educating them to new strategies related to driving, so in fact they can get from one place to another and do so safely, both for themselves and for others who are on the road. Also, it was mentioned that
a question. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for your testimony. I'm wondering what proportion of people 55 and older, by the way, I did take that class and I really got a lot out of it. What proportion of folks 55 and older do take that class?
That I'm not sure. I can get you statistics related to Oregon's program as well as the national program if you like. I just, for the purpose of the day, I just checked the statistics to see how many people had in fact participated and completed the course. But I can get you Oregon specific, I believe.
Thank you.
We've also, it was mentioned that sometimes it is a difficult conversation when we think that a family member perhaps for medical reasons or for any other reason may not be able to drive safely, and it's a very difficult conversation. It's one that I had with my own father several years ago. He's passed away now, but he was only, I think, 71, 72, and had chronic emphysema. And because of that, he was weak, his reaction time had slowed and so forth, and it was not an easy conversation to have. But he also, in talking it over, realized that perhaps driving was not something that he could do safely. But I mention it because AARP, along with the Hartford Group, has developed a brochure and a seminar program that, again, helps family members have that conversation when it needs to take place. What I'm trying to say here is that we, AARP, is committed to ensuring that our roads are safe and that individuals who are unsafe drivers are not on our roads. And as I said, we're supportive of a number of things that we believe will assist us in doing so. We just believe that any particular statute that is arbitrarily age determined is not the way to go, because no matter what age you set it at, you're not going to necessarily solve your problem. And as I've said, 75 is one thing, but the person out there who's 72 or 65 could be impaired and shouldn't be on the road, but you're not going to catch them. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, first of all, I think it's extremely generous of AARP to allow Representative Tomei to take the class so many years before she's qualified for membership. That's a generous act on your part. My colleague to my
right. As far as I know, she paid the fee then.
She paid the fee. Okay. She's not good. My colleague to my right is a pilot, I believe, and he could inform better than I. But there are restrictions on if I had my pilot's license at age 49, there'd be certain restrictions. My colleague is I think a couple years older than I am, and he faces different restrictions. Do you see that as arbitrary, or is there a point where you actually see that the aging process as not necessarily arbitrary, but as natural and real?
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, that's a good question. And I would only, the only way I think I can answer that is to say that I've seen recent news stories and articles indicating that airline pilots are now trying to get changes in that age, arbitrary age restriction. I believe it's age 60, but suggesting that in fact, it makes no sense to say that I can fly a commercial aircraft at age 60, but a day over that, I can't do so any longer. And in fact, many European countries, I think, have already increased that age as far as flying is concerned. Again, I think you have to look at the functionality of a person as far as whether they can fly a plane or drive a car safely, rather than just using that arbitrary age to determine suddenly we're going to start testing you on a regular basis.
Right. And
yes, follow up.
And I don't mean to be argumentative, but in a sense, it's a check-in. The pilots do a check-in. It's not that Representative Gilman's going to be told when he passes a certain age he could never fly again. It's a check-in that says, hey, how you doing, Representative Gilman? You know, how are things? Or we're just making sure that you are still there. And isn't this bill doing the same thing of saying, we're trying to set up a procedure to check in? And I think the mandatory program, the voluntary program are excellent steps, but are there other steps that ARP would be comfortable with the saying, you know, how do we check in on people's abilities if we do not do it in some sort of systematic
way?
Well,
as I indicated before, we support regular in-person renewal and assessment and testing. And frankly, I was surprised when I came to Oregon a few years ago and realized I got a driver's license that was now good for 8 years. I think that is a long time. But I would suggest everybody should be come in and for an in-person renewal of their license, whether it's 2 years or 4 years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming down. And we have Ronald Pfeiffer. Okay. Thank you. Make sure you identify yourself and where you're from.
Well, I'll try to give the best outline that I can.
Identify yourself.
Okay, I'm Ronald Pfeiffer.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Where are you from?
Marion County,
okay.
Silverton.
Thank you. That's good.
Okay. I would like to say that driving is a right, not a privilege. And we are not living under a monarchy. And we have a constitutional republic here in Oregon and in the United States. Our courts exist for jury trials and civil courts for people that cannot behave in society or make serious mistakes. And I wish to say that there are certain laws that can be introduced that are violation of our constitutional republic. Our founding fathers called them ultra vires acts. That means literally that they are beyond the powers given in the Constitution. In other words, they will be a non-law even if you call them a law. And I have seen that my experience that senior citizens are better than 80% of the other drivers, approximately that percent. And there are people that will be very careful. If they don't have the best day, they just won't go anywhere. They'll go when they feel like it. And they are being severely inhibited because you can't just take a bus anywhere at any time. And there are places and appointments that where they need their own transportation. And these people are part of the economy of Oregon. And if they are crushed under, many of these people are capable of, have great wisdom to pass on to their relatives and friends and to the state. And many are capable of writing books or working on inventions or important business structures. And if they are crushed by Department of Motor Vehicles, many of these seniors give up and die, or they're just too discouraged to function well. And it's hurting, it will hurt, and it is already hurting the state economy. And the people that don't even have an accident record are being jumped on by a DMV. And I don't like the behavior of certain policemen either. They act more like mafia enforcers than peace officers. There are many policemen I respect. I have police friends. But we need to be careful about our freedoms, because it'll all come back to bite us someday. The dragon will come and get all of us. I have found out that the Department of Motor Vehicles testing people are people with minor to severe, not all of them, some of them, minor to severe mental problems. They enjoy power over people. They believe they're always right. One of them I know of in particular, and I know a friend of that family, one of the driving testers, is a psychopathic liar, and they tell lies, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it starts from some little incident they claim happened, which didn't happen, and they build it up to where it happened on a side road, maybe. And then later on, they tell their supervisors it happened at a stoplight. And it just gets bigger and bigger. And I interviewed one of these people. And it's sickening. And I do not think that senior citizens have a chance with DMV. I do not believe that they are fair to senior citizens. They will tend to be more tense and more shook up. And I think that they should be able to come in on a day when it's a good day for them and sit and wait for an appointment, even if they don't get an appointment that day. Because appointments are pretty stringent. They may come in the morning, early in the morning, when their day isn't going perfect yet, and so on. But anyway, DMV, another instance of a DMV driving person. It's just my opinion, because I know the person, that they perhaps are sometimes on too much prescriptions. That's the way this person acted. And this person sat in the car with someone to be tested and actually believed he gave the order to enter into traffic. But he never gave any order. And then some motorcycle guy came and cut in front of the car before any order was given, and he quit the whole test. His nerves were shot. I don't think that's right to have people like that. I don't think it's right to treat senior citizens like they aren't good drivers when they may have only made a couple of small traffic offenses. And I know of one case where a policeman wrote a report against somebody. That's like being judge, jury, and hangman. Once one of these policemen that's over eager Beaver writes to the DMV, you're mud. That didn't happen to me. It happened to other people. Anyway, for instance, one case, he didn't ask the person, why isn't this your best day? He could have been told that he was on the way to see his wife. She only had 2 days left to live. And that can be a bad day for anybody. And so I'm asking, please, that you try to stay within the limits of our constitutional republic. We already have laws that don't allow you to do things that would be considered wrong within a constitutional republic. If someone cannot behave properly, well, then they should be fined heavy enough or whatever. There are certain ways a judge or jury and whatever, civil court can handle a lot of this. But we cannot afford to go to a system that becomes a total police state where you're scared every time you turn around, especially senior citizens. And I ask you, please, to be very careful about these rights that were so concerned about by our founding fathers. And remember, please don't pass a bill that is an ultra-virus act, a non-law, an act that will be beyond the powers given in the Constitution. In other words, where we will be tending towards dictatorship. A license, we live in under a constitutional republic. You take the risk. There are certain risks you take for the Bill of Rights, for the freedoms that we have.
Sorry, can I interrupt? I'm going to interrupt you a minute.
And without these, without a little bit of risk, there is no...
Madam Chair.
We have a question for you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, more of an observation. Okay. And sir, I think you've raised some very good points. I guess speaking as one representative in this building on behalf of the citizens of Oregon, we apologize if the state of Oregon has served you or any of your acquaintances as it's worked with the DMV. I can assure you from my personal perspective, the Division of Motor Vehicles has always been forthright and professional in their handling of me and my family. And so I think you've raised some very good points today.
Madam Chair.
Thank you for that. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam
Butler.
Chair. And if the testifier could remain on point with regard to this bill and,
right.
and not to those items that aren't germane to the bill, it would be appropriate. And I appreciate the discussion of constitutionality, but we need to remain on task.
Thank you. So if you want to stick to the bill and finish up.
Pardon me?
If you want to go ahead and stick to the message in the bill and finish up, that would be great.
Okay, I will summarize by saying that, again, that senior citizens that I know about, and I'm a pretty good observer, haven't had to travel a long ways many times. They're excellent drivers. I see many new foreign people and younger drivers that have difficulty being polite or do proper driving. And I even see policemen violate laws by turning in the wrong way on a one-way street and so on, or making loop turns that aren't really legal unless they got an emergency and they aren't just going home. They should follow the law, too. But anyway, I think that it is, I do not believe that DMV will be fair to these people 75 years old and older. And like I said before, I'm witness to, and I have other people witness to, some flaws with some of these people. So please be very careful.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for your comments, and we will certainly take them into consideration.
Thank you very much. I walked away from duties, errands, and work to be here, and so I appreciate
being here with you. We thank you for coming and sharing with us today and taking the time. I want to go ahead and ask Jack to come back up a minute. I have a couple clarifying questions to ask him, and we'll be done.
Wait, are we going to have a work
almost
session?
Done. Okay. No, we're not going to a work session on the bill.
Yes,
I almost forgot, but thank you. I just wanted to check back in with you on the coming into DMV, because I know at this point, if you're 50 and older, you do have to come in to get your license.
Chair Beyer, that's correct. You need to come into DMV if you're 50 or older for an eye exam when you have a renewal. But also, every 8 years, you have to come back in to DMV to renew your license. You really can't do it by mail anymore. So, in a sense, every single renewal in Oregon is an in-person renewal.
And is that in effect now or
That's
going
correct.
Into?
That's correct. That is in effect now and has been, I think Tom was telling me, since around 2000 or so.
And that's for everyone?
That's for everybody.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you so much.
I have a question, but I have a comment, if I may.
Yes.
Madam Chair. There is no more testimony?
No more testimony. I assume not. I didn't ask, but I think we got through everybody who signed up. So,
I just wanted to say on the record that I think this is an important bill. And having seen my father, who was legally blind, still driving, and I refused to ever ride with him or let my children ride with him. And literally, he was legally blind in California. He continued to get his driver's license. He died the day he was out riding his motorcycle. And you made sort of a funny comment. We used to say that about my father, too. But he literally died with his boots on. He was out riding his motorcycle. This is in Los Angeles. And it was not easy to have his license. It was impossible. And having seen that with my mother-in-law and my stepmother-in-law, both of them in their 90s, who were terrible drivers, and the family could not have their license taken away. I think this is a serious problem, and I think it's one that this committee should be looking at and giving some consideration to. So I hope that we have further hearings and we'll seriously look at this bill.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, could I ask?
Yes.
But I thought we had testimony from the DMV that between the self-reporting and the medical reporting, and this was a question we'd ask about my parents with their driver's license, who's going to have to tell Dad that he can't drive anymore? Unfortunately, nobody ever had to tell him And he told us straight out, no one is ever going to be taking my license away from him. That's all there is to it. But the police would monitor him as he would come and go, bless his heart, too. But my concern is that we do have a pretty good reporting system. The indication is that there are several thousands of people in a year that get reported or are self-reporting for the follow-up, and that seems to be pretty effective. So I appreciate the fact that there are people that are coming in and saying, I still qualify for my license, but when they're blind in Oregon at age 50, they're going to find them.
Well, thank you. I was going to say in 2003, if I remember right, we passed a law to let people drive who are legally blind with assisting devices. So
we did do that.
I will go ahead and have a discussion with the sponsor of this bill and see what she wants to do at this point. And then we'll take it from there. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2639. And I'm going to open a work session on committee bill introduction.
You have previously very kindly presented to each member of the committee LCs 3523 and LC 3532. I would make a motion that LC 3523 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Butler moves LC 23 to be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussions? Any objections? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move that 3532 be introduced as a committee bill on behalf of the Transportation Committee.
Representative Butler moves LC 3532 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none? So moved. And I'm going to close the committee, and we will see you on Monday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.